You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance, and this is the second series of Studio Visit, the show dedicated to exploring the ideas, concepts and contexts underpinning the work of contemporary artists who are working today. That was our new theme tune that played us in there, which was Ludwig van Beethoven's Ode to Joy, played by Wendy Carlos, formerly Walter Carlos, for all you synth aficionados out there. So this evening, I'm joined by an artist who's created some of the most exciting work I've seen in the 21st century. Ursula Mayer works in a variety of mediums, but it is as a filmmaker that her investigations into the legacy of modernism have been enchanting audiences everywhere. I feel extremely lucky to have Ursula here with me this evening because we've been trying for a long time to get her on the show. We finally have her and she has a cough. So if she has a coughing fit during the show, please forgive her. She's ill and she's sacrificing her well-being to be here for the sake of art. So Ursula, thank you for coming this evening. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
So let's just start off easily and we'll start from the beginning. So you were born in Austria. What was the city like where you grew up? Was it a big city, a small city? Or?
I grew up in a very, very tiny village. And, you know, it's a village with 2,000 inhabitants in the between Vienna and Salzburg, between the mountains. And when I grew older, I went to Vienna to study.
And what I wondered, one of the things I like to ask people is how they became exposed to art or contemporary art. A lot of people talk about kind of formative exposure to, not necessarily formative, but, you know, coming across a coffee table book of Picasso or Matisse or something. And I'm wondering, what did you have a specific moment where you saw a work and were like, oh, that's what I want to do?
I mean, I was not very much exposed to art when I was young, neither to films. I mean, I watched TV, of course, but not to cinema. And I think the first piece of art I seen, which I was really struck, was a painting by Monet, which is Seerosen.
Mm.
It's German title. And actually it was in London.
Mm.
Because I did an exchange with my school and I went to the National Gallery.
Oh, in Leicester Square.
Yeah, and I think I was amazed by that painting. Yeah.
So you from Sleepy Town to London to study at Goldsmiths, and you graduated in 2002, is that right?
2005.
But 2002, I guess I'm dating it back to then because that was the year you made Gold Flames in the Sky.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
So can you maybe just, because I haven't managed to see this work, so maybe could you tell us a bit about the piece?
Gold Flames Out in the Sky is a video work I did on Second World War tower in Vienna, and from Hitler times.
Mm.
And I started at that point to work with video. I started actually to work with performance, and I made music. I had bands, and it was also the time when in Austria the government was really white, because originally I was studying painting, and then but to stay in your studio as a painter felt like really not right at that time. So a lot of people actually started to perform and you know, do other things. So did I. And so basically I did, it sounds ridiculous, but I did spit fire on that tower in a very glamorous outfit, which I made by myself, which was a golden leather trouser with stitched on icons of music, also from David Bowie to Madonna to everybody. And yeah, and then the way it was edited, it was a little bit like kind of Pipilotti wrist music video style, something which people did in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was you. It was you.
It was actually me.
Because yes. I should explain, as I haven't seen this film, but I have seen a still image, and it's this spectacular still image that's kind of like a cyberpunk version of Caspar David Friedrich's A Guy on the Mountain.
Oh, that's a nice description. Thank you. I like that.
And it has Ursula, this huge ball of flame coming from, your mouth.
Yeah.
So how?
It's not so difficult to do that, actually.
Is it not?
No.
So did you just take it up and learn it? Or?
I just wanted to do it, tried it, and I did it, you know. And I also had a firewall installed behind me. Mm. So I had this special effect, and I'm turning in front of it. So it's quite spectacular. So it also plays a little bit with music video aesthetics, you know. So it's, yeah.
And so that seemed to be, I mean, I guess, another work that you did early on, Acoustic Mirror, mm-hmm. was also, would you say that was a similar vocabulary, music?
I became kind of interested in the phenomenon of punk, you know, the kind of mixture between music, politics and fashion, and also women in punk, you know, because they were quite important in terms of, you know, women discovered the stage basically in punk and made their own music and the whole Wired girl movement later on. And so I asked female front singers of bands to reinterpret a song of... I don't remember the band anymore.
Oh, please. I know. I the Auteurs. Think,
I didn't think you would ask me about so early
the
work.
Au pairs,
sorry. Yeah, the Au Pairs. Come again. So everybody interpreted this song in a mirror box. And at that point, I think I was already kind of interested in Dan Graham's work, you know, also Rock My Religion, and also the, you know, film and audience, all his experimental or performative work he did in the 70s. Because basically they performed in this mirrored box. And so you could see the camera. You could see the spectator as the camera, and then it was also projected in the mirrored box. So when you watched the film, you saw yourself as a spectator. So, you know, there's a lot of points in that work already, which I kind of, you know, it's kind of an interest, but, you know, it's a very early version.
And I think what struck me as interesting about that is just the idea of the cinematic representation of the female, and this discourse of how the female is not really able to be sort of self-possessed, that they exist as an object onto which the male viewer projects their desires. And anyway, we're not going to get so deep into psychoanalysis, but it will pop up, I should warn listeners. But it just interested me because that was just like full on. It could be read as a kind of Lacanian Lacanian infinity trap.
Yeah, that's an interesting reference. I mean, there's of course I'm talking about the objectification of women, but on the other hand, I'm also talking about the totally opposite potential, you know, about the glamorous, you know, punk is actually the opposite. So yeah. I'm actually, you know, playing with this controversial, actually, in this work.
So you switched these early films that we're talking about, and I just wanted to touch on them so that we could prepare the way for a discussion about your film work, which is really, you've been a kind of major body of work has been coming out in the past sort of five, six, seven years, maybe. And what I wanted to ask was, sorry if this seems a bit of a basic question, but what was it that made, was it what made you switch from working with HD and DV cams to working with 16mm film? Because, and also, sorry, one more thing is that I kind of noticed that there's a slight change in approach. What made you switch?
I was interested in the medium film in itself, and in a way, if you work with film, it is 16mm. I recently shot my first 35mm, but with 6mm, it's very different approach. You know, you really, it's also about craft somehow, or you have to work in a different way. You don't have endless time. You have to lit in a specific way. You have to think through a project in a very, very different way. Mm. And I think I was interested to work that out. And then also, all my references moved really into cinema. So I felt like I really should work in this medium.
And there's an essay by, I think, Peter Goodall, which talks about the two avant-gardes, which on one side he's talking about structuralist film, you know, like Paul Sharratt's and those guys. And then on the other hand, he's talking about Godot, Antonioni. That's it. I felt watching your film. Oh, and also I should say there's a general disdain for Hollywood cinema in kind of experimental film circles. Whenever you read essays or kind of compendiums, anthologies of critical writing, Hollywood is the illusionistic monolith on the horizon, and experimental film is trying to keep the audience at a distance and allow the audience to remain critical. And what I sense in what I feel in your films is that there is a blending of those two worlds. So on one hand, I'm pushed away, and on another hand, I'm held close by something that looks so seductive and so enchanting. Is this middle ground? Is that something that fascinates you? This push and pull, to borrow terms from painting and Clement Greenberg, but this push and pull between enchantment and critical distance.
I mean, I'm really playing with this is seductiveness in imagery, I know, and I'm doing that on purpose, of course, and. On the other hand, you never forget the spectator in my work. So I'm kind of interested in this discourse of both. Yeah, you're right. It's kind of true.
And let's talk about Trilogy. So that was in 2006. So this is the work you made just before, Interiors, which was that the first 16mm film? Mm-hmm. So one of the, that the main area around which a lot of your work seems to deal with is the kind of legacy of modernism. And within the legacy of modernism, I guess the cinematic representation of women I suppose architecture gets thrown in there sometimes as well. And was this where you decided to begin working with specific locations? If you know...
The Trilogy, this was my first work where I really was using quite specific architectural location, but also thinking through what the foundation of cinema is in terms of space and time, you know, the structure between that. And In this work, I really was looking at the relationship between cinema and architecture.
And then in Interiors, which is 2006, the first 16mm film, they're in... I should describe the film. So within the film, there are two women who are walking around this house, which is a very particular house, isn't it?
It's an Erna Goldfinger house. In Hampstead, and it was a meeting point in the 30s of modernist artists, and it has a collection of art collected by Erna Goldfinger, the architect, and it's now owned by National Trust, so you can basically visit it.
And there's a Barbara Hepworth sculpture in one of the rooms, isn't there?
Actually, there is no Barbara Hepworth sculpture. No.
Oh, right. Oh, it's
I made that sculpture created a kind of fictional moment around it. So basically there are two women moving through this house. They never meet. They just meet through this object. And on the one hand, they could be mother or daughter, or on the other hand, it could be, you know, the past, the present. So it's not, the narration is not really fixed.
It feels like this is the first moment where you're introducing us to an investigation into memory, and you're asking the audience to participate, to make sense of your work. I feel like as a viewer, that's that's the great, that's what I'm being asked to do. I'm being asked to use my imagination. I'm being asked to use my memory to figure out what's happening on screen. And I felt as if that they could be the same person. And then I wondered, perhaps the older woman is thinking of the younger woman, and maybe the younger woman is thinking of the older woman. And it also made me think of the idea of psychological and emotional interiors. And again, the idea of women, and the idea that women in cinema aren't allowed to have an interiority, they're all surface. So I just felt that there was so much in that first film. Was I right to read into it?
It's an open-ended narration, and it's constructed as a special narration and through an ellipse of time. And you can read the narration how you want to read it. You know, there's no story I give at the end.
Boy was in the hallway drinking a glass of tea. From the other end of the hallway, a rhythm was generating. Another boy was sliding up the hallway. His gold nerves merged perfectly. He merged perfectly with the mirror in the hallway. The boy looked at Johnny. Johnny wanted to run, but the movie kept moving as planned. The boy took Johnny. He pressed him against a locker. He drove it in. He drove it home. He drove it deep in Johnny. The boy disappeared. Johnny fell on his knees. Started crashing his head against a locker. Started laughing hysterically when suddenly Johnny gets a feeling he's been surrounded by horses, 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 horses coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, 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 singing on how the pony, like Boney Maroney. Do you know how to twist?
Yeah.
forest. There is a mare, black and shining, with yellow hair. I put my fingers through her silken hair and found a stair. And I don't waste time, I just walk right up and saw that up there. There is a sea up there. There's a sea up there. There's a sea, sees the possibility. There's no land but the land. There's no sea but the sea.
There's no keeper
of the key.
There's a wall of possibilities.
Possibilities
up there. There are several walls.
Possibilities
up there.
First possibility is the sea around me. I'm standing there with my legs spread like a sailboat. I felt his hand on my knee on the screen, and I looked at Johnny and handed him a branch of coral flame in the heart of man. The waves were coming in like Arabian stallions, gradually lapping into seahorses. He picked up the blade and he pressed it against his smooth throat, spoon, and let it dip in the veins, dip in to the sea, to the sea of possibilities. Dip in,
it started hardening in my hand,
to the sea,
and I felt the arrows
of possibilities.
Of
I put my hand inside his cranium. Oh, we
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM, and this is Studio Visit. I'm here with contemporary artist Ursula Meyer, and we're still in thick of talking about her practice. If you've just joined us, we were sort of midway through a set of films, well, the period where Ursula switched from DV to working with 16mm, and I wanted to talk about a couple of other works now. One is called The Crystal Gaze, and the other is called The Lunch in Fur. One of the things that in your work, which is sort of apparent when you compare it to other works, is the kind of the beauty of the work and the way I guess you use actors quite a lot, and they seem to be really comfortable. And so I wondered how you have developed as a director. Have you found it difficult to work with artists, or is it something that's come naturally?
You mean with actors, or
yeah, with actors.
I mean, I think it was more. It was actually The Crystal Gaze. It was the first time that I used a script, so it's a different way of engaging, you know, or, you know, it becomes more complex because it's about acting. It's not just about movement. So, but I think, you know, I spend a lot of time with casting, and a lot of times, actually, people give me the idea because. Or the casting process is really important. It kind of refines actually everything, how it should be exactly or how it can be, because someone portrays something or is something or brings me something which I really like and then incorporate in the film. And I really like the process.
And which comes first? Does the script come first, or does the casting come first?
Usually the script is first, and the last thing is kind of the casting.
And I wondered about site, because obviously that's really, really important. And the building that's used in The Crystal Gaze is another interesting location. Could you tell us?
It's Eltham Palace, another location which is kind of museum or national trust or national heritage. And it's an Art Deco palace, and I was kind of interested in how Art Deco was used as a feature in early Hollywood films. So I used that location as a fictional character and, you know, set as a set for this film.
When you talk about buildings as fictional characters, it kind of reminded me of, well, The Shining, because, you know, there's that awful, horrible building where people get killed and repossessed.
That happens all the time in my films, does it?
No, but, you know, I mean, I guess the idea of a building being alive, it also reminded me of Matthew Barney's Cremaster cycle in the Chrysler building. Not because they share, they're the same, but just that recurring feature. And I want, like, the characters in the film speak dialogue as kind of a fragmented dialogue, which seems to be about a memory of a selfhood that's gone awry, and a memory of a relationship with something or someone. And I wonder, they're not separate characters. Is it just one voice, or is it the voice of the building? Is it the memory of the events that have happened there?
I think it's a mixture between a lot of things. It's also, in a way, sometimes it just, my scripts often work just as another layer. It's the same, like an image. Sometimes they just describe what's happening on what they're actually doing, you know, just describe their actions. You could see it as a voice from spaces. I mean, I didn't think in that way, but you could definitely.
And what about musical choices? Because there's that song, Is That All There Is?
It just fitted really well, the work, because it's Peggy Lee, who was working in Hollywood, and she was a tragic comic figure. And I think it really, I think it was great to have this kind of tragic comic element in that film, you know, to release this high pressure of stylized imagery.
And with modernism, because when people use modernism, they tend to just throw the term around. I never really know in what way they're engaging the term. Do they mean, especially when, say, if they talk about architecture, it's modernist. So do you mean it's about utility and it's about getting rid of decoration? Or when you're talking about art, modernism in art, it's about abstraction?
I think it's a lot about the utopians, the ideas, utopias which were promised, and I think it's all about unfulfilled promises, and I think about the potential, and I think that's kind of, a lot of people looked in this way into the legacy of modernism, and in a way, or rewriting it, you know, rewriting kind of history. So I think, you know, you could see that a lot in recent works, and maybe in some of my works, first I'm interested in a modernist legacy also in of cinema, then, and if I use specific locations or things or specific storylines which relate to that legacy, I'm kind of, you know, create my own fictions and kind of put my spotlight in a different way and maybe discuss failed potentials or another possibility of thinking through that.
But I also feel that your work goes beyond just an investigation into a failed utopia.
Yeah,
and I feel as if it offers a possibility for engagement, or it's still enacting that kind of line of sincerity or that line of a belief in some kind of a transcendental experience beyond just signifying physical reality or beyond just talking about a discourse or doing a piece of work that's supposed to address something. There's something about your work that is difficult to pin down, that is mysterious, that is enchanting. And sometimes I feel like these elements that we sort of shy away from in the austere sort of climate of contemporary art, following conceptual art, following minimalism, where things have to be ordered in a specific way and expressive force gets pushed to one side. And sometimes I feel like that is something that happened in modernism. This enchantment, this idea in some sort of transcendental otherness. So say like in someone like Martha Graham, there's a power there, there's a depth, there's a wealth of emotion that we as an audience are being asked to experience or understand. And I just feel like your work does something on a similar lines. Like when we were talking earlier about when I first saw another piece of your work called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I saw it at Fries Art Fair, that's something that just immediately grabbed me, that it's out of this loop of kind of materialist concerns and is somehow placed somewhere else. Is my imagination just working over time, or does the idea of enchantment, or is the idea of the mysterious, the idea of hypnosis even? Can I? Let's be specific. So I want to talk to you about Gonda, and what I want to do first is I'm gonna play an excerpt from Gonda so people can get an idea of, I guess, some of the qualities that I'm talking about. You won't be able to see it, but you'll at least be able to hear what it's like. So this is an excerpt from Gonda.
Ethereal, sidereal, funereal, arterial, venereal, immaterial, ethereal, sidereal, funereal.
A human is defined by potential, not by obedience to template.
In that way, her handwriting was future-producing.
A human cannot alone carry the burden of revolution. It would excise their subjectivity and place it in a surface of fears and anxieties they had not themselves created. There is something about me I can give a name
comma.
To. Something I had and lost.
Comma.
Yet feel as if I am keeping for myself, for all of us.
To ask about when you met Valentin de Hing, who is playing the central character in Gonda. So I should say, for the benefit of listeners out there who obviously may not have seen the work, Gonda was a collaboration, I guess, between you and a writer called Maria Fusco, and I suppose a launch pad, or a place that you departed from, was a kind of little known play by Ayn Rand called Ideal. Mm-hmm. And the play itself was about an actress called Kay Gonda, who was idolized by lots of people. And then when she sort of hardship came her way, she stepped out of the screen and asked people for help and was rejected. So that's the background. But now I just want to talk about the film that you and Maria Fusco provided the script for, and about Valentin de Hing. Who was a model, right? Mm-hmm. How did you come about working with her?
Basically, a lot for this film developed through the process of making the script or working with Maria on it, and we had workshops, and we invited artists and curators, and kind of discussing cluster things around Unwound. So basically we used the text, and there are parts of the original text in the script, and then Maria provided the rest. And of course, you know, I mean, Unwound is a very controversial figure, and we kind of tried to construct an oppositional voice to Rand's voice. And after the script, which was for a single female voice, I decided to actually split it and work with more people or more actors. And then I also decided I don't really want to work with actors. I want to work with models. Because I was kind of interested in their androgynous, so I casted Valentin der Hing. So I casted her through a Skype interview I had, and I was immediately really, I thought she's perfect, because of course, you know, models, it's not necessary that models can act. So with her, I was really lucky because she also studies literature, and she was very much exposed to theater in her childhood. So, and the script, in addition, the script is really complex, and it's difficult to learn. And it was quite impressive how she could deliver it. And I think she's amazingly talented, and I want to work again with her because she's great.
Yeah, I thought it was... I thought she was incredible, actually. And one of the... When I was sort of rambling a bit earlier and I sort of mentioned hypnosis, it again goes back to that feature that I was talking about earlier, of being maybe held at a distance and simultaneously embraced. Because, you know, there's those sections in Gonda where you accent the syntax of speech by having the, are they gunshots? It feels like they're gunshots.
At some point, there's some gunshots, yeah.
Yeah, ethereal, sidereal, I can't remember all of it. But, you know, in some way, you could say that the repetition or the way the sort of rhythmic nature of the editing might be putting some people at a distance. But I felt like that was quite a hypnotic device, that it pulled me further in to the events that were unfolding in the film.
I guess you're an experienced viewer of films, I don't know.
Well, no, I just feel like the film demands something of the viewer. You can't remain passive when you're watching it. You have to... It's difficult to watch.
You said it's... Okay. I mean, it's a non-linear text, you know, and there's parts of it which is used as a form of as a visual lexicon. There are five color fields, there are five different objects,
right?
And they're always accompanied by the voiceover and the punctuation marks. And also the film plays with a lot of different genres. In a way, they're open fluid structures. They're like, there's wasteland, there's a fashion shoot, there's theatrical performance. So there is an absence of a narrative structure, but on the other hand, you know, it's changes. So I'm playing with all these different devices.
And I wanted to ask you about location. How did you find? Because are they tasked? Where's that? Valentine is one of the scenes in the film where she's on this kind of mountainous terrain, which looks like black sand almost.
That's filmed in Italy, on Etna, on the volcano. Yeah. So we filmed there for a day.
And then the other location is a kind of studio space.
That's just a very normal theatre space, you know.
And that's the thing, you manage, a lot of people work with 16mm film, and a lot of people work with different types of film and talk about film as a language and talk about the quality of film and what it can do. But I really, really feel with your work that it actually comes to fruition. And I mean, from it being, I've seen your work in 16mm and in sort of a digital transfer, and they feel completely different. That there's a real, it feels as if there's a, like a physical presence when you see your films projected into space. Go ahead, sorry.
No, I mean, with some films, it's really important that they are shown on 16mm because they're playing with this ambiguity if it's like found footage material, you know, if it's something which is from that time, you know, but then at some point you figure out it's not so. But Gondor, for example, is shown digitally. Mm. So it's different work, different context.
So I want to talk to you about your newest piece or what you're working on at the moment. But before that, we're going to play a piece of music by J.D. Sampson. And this is a new band because she used to be in a band called La Tigra.
Yeah.
And now she's in...
She has her own band now, which is called Man.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a couple of years, yeah.
And this track we're going to play now is Who Am I to Feel So Free? So that was J.D. Sampson in a that was Men with J.D. Sampson being the lead singer in the band with Who Am I to Feel So Free, and so you're working with J.D. on a new project at the moment. Could you give us a bit of an exclusive? Tell us a bit what.
No, I just shot the film in Turkey.
Oh, you did? Her.
Yeah. That's my first 35mm film. So basically, the starting point of that work is a film by Pasolini, Medea, which was filmed in the same location I went, which is Cappadocia. It's like ancient caves with Christian churches. And Pasolini casted Maria Calla as Medea, and in a way, it's a film also about her. So I kind of used the same strategy as him. So it's both. It's, you know, it's also a film about J.D. Sampson, a portrait film. But what I was especially interested, or why I went to that location, is because there was one scene I was intrigued, and it's the film. It's the scene of the stealing of the Golden Fleece, which is the main kind of. In Pasolini's terms, it would be an important part in the film. So, sorry, he would interpret it as the downfall of humankind, because it shows the greed, and it shows like the capitalist vision of our society. And I guess it never changed, and it's still the same. And in the film, it's just beautifully the way it's filmed. So I went back basically with JD and kind of reimagined something similar, or, you know, my own interpretation of that scene. So, yeah.
So this character of Medea, does that feature in The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight as well?
Actually, yes, I was already working with that as well, because I actually wanted to do already the film in Turkey at that point, and I was casting Susie Sue.
And really?
Yes.
Wow.
But it didn't work out at the end, so I had to postpone it. And now I'm really happy that I work with a younger generation. JD, she was fantastic. So
really?
It was good that it took a little bit longer.
And so what were some of the locations that you used? Was it a similar shoot to the one you did with Valentin, where you were outside and inside in a studio space? Or
no, it's actually just it's in caves, mostly.
Wow.
Blazing caves. They're all now, it's a World Heritage, and basically they're national parks. So that was a little bit tricky, and also a little bit disappointing, because I had the imagination, you know, I find everything like in the 70s, but it's of course not late 60s. So basically, no, it just plays inside these caves and outside the caves. So there's no studio space this time.
Was that a bit of a challenge with it? Because we haven't talked about your crew, but it must be huge. Because serious listeners, when I'm saying, I keep talking about the sensual quality and how enchanting Ursula is, and she's shaking her head across to me. But it's because they look so good. And
I was really lucky. I worked with Margaret Salmon. She's also an artist, a great artist. And she worked with me on my last two films, Gonda and this one. She doesn't usually do that, but we are friends, so she agreed to do it. And before that, I had actually quite big crews, and I had lighting and everything, and I really tried to turn that down a little bit and come back again to having more time and more space to actually work. Because if you have a huge crew, it's all about, you know, time, money, and there's really no space. If you have some other ideas, suddenly, you know, it's really restricted. So you can achieve, you know, quite a lot if you work with people, you know, with great people.
And do you have a sense of ease now? Because I would imagine when you have a big crew and you're working on something that has a specific, you have a unique vision, that it somehow, it must be quite challenging to pull everybody in together to working that in that singular focus to achieve what it is you're setting out to do.
Yes, but I think if you work with people like, you know, who come from a specific, not coming, who are not coming just from, or not coming from the film industry, and so you can make these visions, or you know you can create them, and it's great to arrange this situation where things like this can happen. I think that's always really exciting to do that.
And I'm just so excited about this film that you're telling us about. So how long is the film? Is it another?
No, it's actually a shorter film. Mm. I'm not quite sure yet because I'm editing and I'm playing around with different things. But JD is making some music. She's actually working on some music now. And I mean, it's not a music clip, you know, but there's also a script. Mm. And so I'm actually giving myself some time to decide how long it will be, but maybe 15 minutes, you know.
Mm. And it feels like the two periods are kind of colliding, because you had the earlier period where you're working with these punk figures from punk, and then you moved into a kind of, you know, this modernist era, and now they're both colliding, and it just feels so exciting. Do you feel as if that's happening?
Actually, that did excite me too, because you know, early on when I was kind of making music or playing with this phenomenon of punk and you know, working with that more in a conceptual way, and now I'm actually casting people or working in a different way with it, I really liked it. You know, I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting after, I don't know, when this, you know, 10 years, how things come back, but in a different way. Mm. And it's a permanent, you know, combination of things which you already did, but on another level, and you know, you're connecting these stories you create together, and it grows in a way. I was excited when I casted JD. Mm. It was fun.
And how did you approach it? I mean, you said to me that it how did you guys come to work together?
Basically, I was in New York for half a year recently, and I met her, and I told her about the project, and she really liked it, so we agreed on working on it. It was more difficult to, you know, find the time because people are busy, and, you know, to find the right time for everybody if there's so many people involved. But yeah, finally it happened.
And so what you missed, but I will bring up, is
But
that
I have to say, I was also really excited to work with Valentine de Hing. She was also fantastic.
I mean, yeah, I think it's this direction. That
they're both really great. And also all my other performers, you know, if someone would listen now and hear that, so I should be careful.
As I say, in each piece, the performances that come out of from the performance, or that you manage to conjure from the performances, are really quite startling. And that one becomes so used to seeing amateurishness in contemporary art film, or one almost comes to see it as a hallmark or a mark of legitimacy. But so it's kind of a breath of fresh air to be able to see how people sort of come alive in your film.
There's some amateurism also involved, and I think it's sometimes quite good.
No,
you know,
yeah,
it needs to be there, and it makes, you know, it needs to be the, it has to have the lightness to have that.
So we're coming to the final moments of the show now, and I personally want to say a big thank you to Ursula for Brave. She's been, you have to feel sorry for her listeners, because she has a cold and a cough, and she's been
I'm not too bad.
She's been sitting
I'm having a cough, that's all.
Yeah, eating whole sweets. But before we go, you did mention before we came on air that you saw somebody famous on the street in New York.
A long time ago.
Yeah, I know, but it's because you saw David Bowie, right, on the street in New York.
Yeah, but that was 1997.
I'm just mentioning it now because he's back with a new track and a video that
looks
like Tony
Hustler.
I'm not
going
to play it now. We've run out of time, so we're going to have to play out with our theme, as we do. But, you've been listening to Studio Visit on Resonance 104.4 FM. We're back. This is the second season. Make sure you tune in next week, where I'll be talking to Michael Smith, who's one of the legendary sort of pioneers of video art. Do you remember back in the day when there was a thing called TV and video artists were interrogating it with their work? Well, he was one of the pioneers. So make sure you tune in next week. I've been Morgan Quaintance. Thank you very much, Ursula.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening.